to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Saturday, April 24th, but this is airing on Sunday, April 25th. I'm your reader, Natalie Chin, and let's start off with the front page today. Looks like the front page articles are Jefferson students want drum vandals to beat it, Clear Lake approves Starboard Square deal, and nuisance project parks plan okayed. Jefferson students want drum vandals to beat it is the one we'll start with here by J.C. Smith. The students at Jefferson Elementary have a message for whomever is vandalizing the drums on their playground. Please stop. They're sad and confused and even a little angry. Until a month or so ago, the students' playground featured five low-density polyethylene drums that third graders Max Davis, Gregor Adams, and Dante Mateo Mendoza played every day. They can nail Imagine Dragons' Believer. But about a month ago, the students came to school to find one of the drums broken apart. That was a bummer. Then last weekend, a second drum was shattered. That was disheartening. On Friday morning, several students speculated on the cause. Quote, "Teenagers had baseball bats," said kindergartner Aubrey Bear. "You think it was teenagers with baseball bats, but you don't really know," added Principal Lindsay Millsap. Kindergartner Vera Burgess thought it could have been lightning and then possibly teenagers with baseball bats. "Maybe little kids were standing on them," speculated kindergartner Maggie Murray. It didn't matter to Davis. "You shouldn't break someone else's stuff," he said. "The drums mean more than just a fun recess time activity," Davis said. He and his schoolmates did a walkathon, raising money to get those drums and the xylophone that sits with it. Last year, the school also won a national $10,000 grant from Frigo Cheese that also contributed to the set, which costs around $3,500 to $4,000. Each drum runs $600 to $800, Millsap said. Quote, "I'm sad because we like playing songs," said third grader Adams. He later added that he felt it wasn't fair that people can come along and break something that belongs to someone else for no reason. Quote, "It's like all that money went out the window," Davis said. All of them committed to raising more money to replace the drums they've lost, and they really hope this time they'll stay. The Mason City Police Department is investigating the incidents and promised more patrols in the area. Principal Millsap says she's reluctantly installing video cameras for the playground area. Charles City Council approves nuisance project and Parks Department plans by Jared McNett. A little more than a month after approving plans for beginning nuisance abatement on South Johnson Avenue, the Charles City Council moved another such project closer to redevelopment. On Monday night, the municipal body unanimously approved putting out a request for bids on a lot at 312 15th Avenue, where a dilapidated duplex structure sat until very recently. According to city engineer John Fallis, the city is looking to sell the vacant property so someone can redevelop it and place a house there. Quote, "The lot is sufficiently sized for that," Fallis said. The only major issue for a developer would be making sure that a new structure meets the requirements for building on a 100-year floodplain. Based on information found in the agenda for the council meeting, bids on the vacant lot must be submitted to the city and are due by 3 p.m. on May 13th. To hear Charles City Parks and Recreation Director Tyler Mitchell tell it, the pickleball courts that his department oversees have seen better days. With a unanimous vote from the city council, they may soon return to their former glory. The four council members in attendance, Councilmember Starr was absent, decided to sign off on Mitchell's plan to apply for a $20,000 grant that would help the department do repair work on its two pickleball courts. Per the agenda, an estimate from Heartland Asphalt indicated that such work would cost about $36,500 altogether. Quote, "There's a bunch of cracks forming throughout the courts, and it's getting to the point where we need to do something to prevent injuries," Mitchell said. According to him, the courts are used almost every single day by Charles City residents. In 2021, Mitchell said a lot of his department's projects will be focused more on maintenance-type work versus brand-new construction. "With COVID affecting our budget, we're not doing too many projects, but we're going to do renovations of park bathrooms and repair work that doesn't take a lot out of the budget," he said. During the meeting itself, Mitchell indicated that his department would still have enough money to do the project if it didn't receive the grant award, but City Administrator Stephen Deers made sure to point out that if it did occur, the project would have to come before the City Council again. Council gives green light to Grove Street Plan. Potential pickleball court resurfacing wasn't the only time the Mason City-based Heartland Asphalt came up during Charles City Council discussion on Monday night. Heartland wound up being the lowest bidder on the Grove Street South Illinois Street Intersection Improvement Program at $134,646, which was almost $2,000 less than the estimate from the city engineer. Per Fallis, Charles City will be accountable for about $109,000 of the project. The plan is to replace existing pavement and storm sewers in the area with newer materials. Along with that, the site will sport a new guardrail and embankment adjacent to Sherman Creek, according to the agenda item. While that project ramps up, the council helped put a major project to bed by voting 4-0 to approve authorizing final payments on the 2020 HMA paving project that involved resurfacing on Cedar, Clinton, and South Jackson Street, as well as reconstructing 2nd Street from South Main to Cedar Street. The initial approved bid for the project came in at $1,367,736 and finished at $1,565,864. Per the agenda, a majority of that cost overrun is owed to storm sewer repairs and paving abandoned railroad crossings in the area of the work. Clear Lake Council okays Starboard Development Business Incubator by J.C. Smith. The Clear Lake City Council on Monday approved two projects geared toward drawing more business into the city. After a public hearing, the council unanimously approved an agreement for the Starboard Square Commercial Development in Courtway Park on the east side of town. In March, the council signed off on a letter of intent with Momberg Land LLC for the $1 million project that will construct a 6,000 square foot commercial and retail space. It also okayed nearly $300,000 in financial incentives. Starboard Square will be constructed in the city's urban renewal area, making it eligible to receive tax increment financing money. Specifically, the city offered Momberg Land a 7-year incremental property tax rebate, not to exceed $225,000, $50,000 for municipal water and sanitary sewer connections and related improvements, and reimbursements not to exceed $15,000 for professional services for civil engineering and legal fees. Starboard's neighbor to the north is the also under construction 85-room Fairfield by Marriott Hotel with an attached 8,000 square foot conference center. That's scheduled to be complete in August. The council also unanimously approved an incentive program for businesses that might want to set up shop or expand in downtown Clear Lake. The proposed program is geared toward new retail businesses that might need a hand in covering the cost of leasing a brick-and-mortar establishment. It will be available to ground floor for-profit operations new to downtown Clear Lake. Franchises and chain stores would be excluded. Benefits include a maximum of $10,000 in subsidies over 18 months on a schedule that would provide 50% subsidy up to $830 for the first 6 months, 33% subsidy until the end of the first year, and 17% for the final 6 months. If leasing, both the tenant and property owner would have to agree to the terms of the program. In exchange, businesses would agree to be open at least 6 days a week, become a member of the chamber, and actively participate in its events. Businesses must also remain in operation for at least 3 years or be subject to repaying the subsidy. And any business with a facade that's inconsistent with Clear Lake's nostalgic theme would be excluded from participating. Interested businesses would apply to the chamber, which would then make a recommendation to the city council for enrollment. The program would be funded with tax increment financing revenue and does not yet have a ceiling on how much would be spent, said City Administrator Scott Flory. The city administrator noted when he pitched the program to the council in early April that he has had some business interest. When a startup begins operations, a lot of personal financial investment is required before it begins to bring in revenue, Flory noted. Quote, there's going to be a gap, he told the council on April 5th. This program seeks to fill that, unquote. Moving on to the next article, artist applications being accepted for McNider Outdoor Art Market by Melanie Mergen. The Charles H. McNider Art Museum is currently accepting artist applications for its annual McNider Outdoor Art Market. The in-person event takes place Saturday, June 12th from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. on the McNider Art Museum and Mason City Public Library lawns. Last year's art market took place virtually amid COVID-19. Museum staff continue working out the logistics of making the outdoor event as safe as possible, a press release noted. This year, more booth space is being created for artists to better accommodate social distancing. The postmark deadline for artist applications is May 1st. The application can be found at mcniderart.org. For more information, you can also call 641-421-3666 or email Lindsay at lthompson, THOMPSON, at masoncity.net. Decorations guidelines at Elmwood St. Joseph Cemetery adjusted by Melanie Mergen. Decoration guidelines have been adjusted at Elmwood St. Joseph Cemetery in an effort to celebrate the life and history found in the cemetery, while also maintaining proper care of the cemetery grounds, a recent press release stated. Here is what these guidelines include. Year-round, one permanent vase, one permanent eternal light, and one flag and a permanent flag holder is allowed either on the headstone or directly next to the marker. Headstones with two or more people can have up to two vases, two eternal lights, and two flags. Any secondary headstone cannot have any decorations. Cemetery Decoration Opt-Out Program. After hearing feedback from several citizens, the cemetery is offering an opt-out program where loved ones can place a flower box and decorations inside the flower box on the graveside of the headstone. More details are available via the cemetery office. Memorial Day Guidelines. Decorations of any kind are allowed from May 15th until June 9th to celebrate the Memorial Day season. Decorations must be placed near the headstone. Any non-approved decorations left on June 10th will be discarded. Winter Season Guidelines. Decorations of any kind are allowed from November 1st until March 31st every year to celebrate various holidays during the winter months. Decorations must be placed near the headstone. Any non-approved decoration left on April 1st will be discarded. Additionally, cemetery staff note that wildlife and weather can affect decorations and move them from their intended places, and that decorations that have deteriorated and become unsightly will be discarded. The cemetery cannot be held responsible for any decorations placed on the cemetery grounds, the press release said. For more information, contact the cemetery office at Elmwood at masoncity.net or call 641-421-3687. Mason City resident reappointed to State Commission of Veterans Affairs. When Governor Kim Reynolds announced appointments to the state of Iowa's various boards and commissions this past week, a Mason City resident found himself back amongst the ranks. Gary Watnam, a major general with 35 years of service in the Army and Army Reserve, will serve a second term on the Commission of Veterans Affairs, which does advocate work for Iowa veterans and their families. With a new term, Watnam said that top priorities for him and the commission include helping with veteran job training, as well as employment and emergency housing where it's needed. Quote, "We see a few cases every month that we assist on," Watnam said. "I wouldn't say it's terrible, but there are certainly homeless veterans out there, but we also need help veterans who have homes but need assistance maintaining those homes. That's our main focus," unquote. During his time in service, Watnam said that he served everywhere from Vietnam in 1970 to the Pentagon in Washington, D.C. from 1999 until 2004, which means he worked for the Pentagon when it was hit on September 11, 2001. Quote, "None of the personnel in our directorate were killed or wounded, but we had to move our offices because they were damaged by fire and water," he said. Because of all of that time spent in the service, Watnam said he made a lot of meaningful connections which continue to filter through what he does now in his work with the commission and as a member of the Reserve Officers Association. Quote, "It was great to be a soldier for all those years. I loved to soldier, and I loved the contacts I had with the men and the women who served," he said. And the next article here, "Watch Now, Area Fire Agencies Tackle Fire Along Avenue of the Saints," by Lisa Gruet. Smoke could be seen from downtown Mason City as area crews worked to control a large grass fire just off the Avenue of the Saints Friday afternoon. A number of fire departments, along with Cerro Gordo and Mason City Law Enforcement, assisted at a fire just southeast of Mason City along the Avenue of the Saints on Friday. High winds fanned the flames across an expansive stretch of field and led to several hot spots to reignite. Firefighters worked from the hilltop along the shoulder of the highway as additional trucks fought the blaze from below. A Mason City firefighter said no structures were in danger. Lieutenant Governor Adam Gregg, Dallas Clark, received COVID-19 vaccine, by Zach James from the Sioux City Journal. Because Iowa men are falling behind in getting COVID-19 vaccinations, Lieutenant Governor Adam Gregg and former Hawkeyes tight end Dallas Clark stepped up Friday and got their shots at an event at the Siouxland Expo Center. According to Gregg, 2.1 million doses of the vaccine have been distributed among Iowans, but the split isn't even among men and women. More women have been getting the vaccine by 12 percentage points. Women have gotten 56% of the doses, men 44%. Recent polling has shown one-third of men do not plan to get the vaccine, and 40% of rural residents aren't planning on being vaccinated, according to Greg. Quote, "We're concerned that disparity is going to grow," Greg said. "Guys, why are we falling short? We're here to persuade you that it's the right thing to do for you, your family, and your community. By getting the vaccine, you're protecting your loved ones," unquote. Greg, Clark, and prominent members of the Sioux City sports scene gathered to help promote the state's message. Quote, "The only thing that makes sense is getting the vaccine," said Clark, who played 143 games in the NFL. "I want to encourage people to get vaccinated. I fall into that category of younger 40s age and thinking, oh, I don't need to worry about getting vaccinated because it's not going to be available. It's going to be a while until I make that decision. Now, it's our choice, and we have to do our part. I think you have to put away the politics, this or that, or whatever reason you're not getting it. I really hope you reflect and change that mind and become more proactive," Clark added. Clark received his second shot of COVID-19 as he was originally scheduled to receive his second dose on Thursday in Humboldt. Moving on to the next article, Iowa Auditor Rob Sand considering run for governor or Senate, by Aaron Murphy. Rob Sand, the Democratic Iowa State Auditor, said Friday he is considering three options for next year's elections: run for re-election as auditor, run for governor, or the U.S. Senate. Followers of Iowa politics have suspected Sand, a former staffer in the state attorney general's office, elected auditor in 2018, may have his eye on the governor's office or Iowa's U.S. Senate seat in 2022. Sand confirmed those suspicions Friday during a taping of this weekend's episode of Iowa Press on Iowa PBS. Republican Governor Kim Reynolds plans to run for re-election, and Republican Chuck Grassley, age 87, has not yet announced whether he will seek an eighth term in the U.S. Senate. The Cook Political Report rates Iowa's gubernatorial election as likely Republican, and the Senate race, solid Republican. Sand said he does not have a self-imposed timetable for when he will make this decision. Quote, "I've got a 4.5-year-old, a freshly minted 7-year-old at home. These are big questions. They're hard to balance, and there are certainly things that weigh in both directions," Sand said. "I just haven't finished weighing them," unquote. Sand is considered a rising star among Iowa Democrats. The 38-year-old attorney in 2018 joined Attorney General Tom Miller and Treasurer Mike Fitzgerald as the only Democrats to win a statewide election in the past 13 years. Sand's comments mirror those of Democratic U.S. Representative Cindy Axne, who recently told the Storm Lake Times newspaper that she is considering whether to run for a third term in the U.S. House or run for the U.S. Senate or governor. Whether drawing on his role as state auditor and a taxpayer watchdog, or with political motivation, Sand offered plenty of criticism for Reynolds and her administration. Sand criticized Reynolds' dispersal of federal pandemic relief funding and for the lack of state pandemic relief funding, and gave credit for the state's COVID-19 vaccine rollout not to the administration, but to a couple of social media accounts that helped Iowans find open vaccination appointments. Quote, "People who know small-town Iowa, when I grew up in Decorah, the feeling of a business closing down hurts. It is what people talk about for weeks. And you look around the state right now, and you have people who have poured their lives into creating a gathering place for their community, and it might be the only one there. And now this pandemic comes along, and through no fault of that business owner, they have had to shut down, and they have lost their business," Sand said. "Small towns need those gathering places where people can see each other, and the fact that they have been unwilling to help, unwilling to assist, to me, is wild," unquote. Reynolds previously said there is not enough money in the state budget to help all of Iowa's businesses impacted by the pandemic. Iowa governments, businesses, and individuals have received more than $8 billion in federal pandemic relief funding. This week's episode of Iowa Press will air on Iowa PBS at 7:30 p.m. Friday and noon Sunday. The show can also be viewed online at iowapbs.org. Policy, not dollars, may delay Iowa Republican agreement on human services budgets, by James Q. Lynch, a special from the Globe Gazette. A House panel has approved a 76-page health and human services budget that would spend nearly $2.05 billion from the state's general fund and another $425 million from other funds on Iowa's myriad health and social programs. That's an increase of nearly $60 million in general fund dollars from this fiscal year's budget, according to the Legislative Services Agency, but $14.5 million less from the other funds. The budget approved Thursday by the House Health and Human Services Appropriations Subcommittee is more than the Senate's $2.03 billion budget that would increase spending by $36.9 million. The dollar differences may be less of a barrier to agreement, as well as to adjournment that is scheduled for the end of the month, than policy language majority Republicans have included in their budgets. House Republicans sent a clear message that their requirement that health insurers pay for telehealth mental services at the same rate as in-person treatment must be included in the budget. Access to telehealth is seen as key to improving the availability of mental health services across Iowa, which ranks 44th in the nation for psychiatrists per capita. That need and demand for telehealth services has been highlighted by the coronavirus pandemic, HHS Appropriations Chairman Joel Fry, a Republican from Osceola, said. In the quarter preceding the pandemic, there were 9,386 uses of telehealth among Iowa's Medicaid population, which covers 25% of all Iowans. That jumped almost 2,000% to 185,205 in the next quarter, with the largest increases in behavioral testing, alcohol and drug abuse treatment, vision and hearing testing, and evaluation and management. The Senate plan has two policy changes not included in the House budget: a real-time verification system for public assistance programs under the management of the Department of Human Services, and $50 million to implement the repeal of the mental health property tax levy, with the state taking over funding of those services. The latter is a non-starter in the House, Speaker Pat Grassley, a Republican from New Hartford, told reporters on Thursday. Quote, in its current form with no guardrails, I don't see any interest in the House to begin down that path, he said. We really have to look at services, the inequity that may exist with services across the state. Some regions offer more than others, unquote. Senate Republicans are open to changes, Senate Majority Leader Jack Whitfer, a Republican from Ankeny, responded. Our goal is stable, reliable funding for mental health and property tax relief, Whitfer said in a written statement. The House budget plan, approved on a party-line vote Thursday, would appropriate $45 million more for Medicaid, including a $20 million increase for nursing homes, $11 million for home and community-based services, and $7.1 million for home-based services for disabled Iowans, $3.9 million for psychiatric medical institutions for children, and $1 million to reduce the children's mental health wait list, and $2 million for home health provider rates. Subcommittee Democrats said they would have liked more time to look at the budget, but its last-minute delivery was consistent with Republicans' lack of transparency. In their weekly newsletters, House Democrats said Republicans have reached a stalemate and are refusing to compromise with each other and shutting the public and other lawmakers out of the budget process. Call for Action Closes Climate Summit by Ellen Nickmeyer, Kristen Larson, and Seth Borenstein. World leaders shared tales of climate-friendly breakthroughs and feverish quests for more to close President Joe Biden's virtual global climate summit on Friday, from Kenyans abandoning kerosene lanterns for solar to Israeli startups straining for more efficient storage batteries. It was a persuasive end to an unusual pandemic-era summit hosted from a specially created TV-style set in the White House East Room. Biden's two-day gathering briefly united the heads of global rivals America, China, and Russia, on screens anyway, long enough to pledge cooperation on climate. It also saw the U.S. and half dozen allies commit to significant new efforts and financing to reduce climate-damaging emissions. Friday's closing message, go forth and spend, making good on pledges for rapid transitions to cleaner vehicles, power grids, and buildings to stave off the worst of global warming. Quote, the commitments we've made must become real, declared Biden, who is seeking $2.3 trillion from Congress for legislation that would partly go for electric charging stations, for laying out an efficient new national electric grid, and for capping abandoned oil and gas rigs and coal mines. Commitment without doing anything is a lot of hot air, no pun intended. We're going to do this together, Biden said, speaking live to a final Zoom-style screen of leaders of national governments, unions, and business executives around the world. His closing message echoed the sentiments of Kenyan President Uhuru Muigai Kenyatta, who told the summit, we cannot win this fight against climate change unless we go globally to fight it together, unquote. Compared with the United States and other wealthy but carbon-addicted nations, Kenya stands out as a poorer country, closing the technology gap despite limited financial resources. It has become a leading user and producer of geothermal and wind power. Small solar panels that charge lights and mobile phones have become cheap enough for some poor households to replace their kerosene lanterns. Opposition has stalled work on what would be the first dirtier-burning coal-fired power plant. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, meanwhile, described scientists at hundreds of Israeli startups working to improve crucial battery storage for solar, wind, and other renewable energy. Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen of Denmark renewed her country's pledge to end oil and gas exploration in the North Sea, switching from offshore oil and gas rigs to wind farms. Biden convened the summit, showcasing the United States' own high-profile return to international climate efforts after President Donald Trump's withdrawal. Biden used the summit to announce he intended to cut U.S. coal and petroleum emissions in half by 2030, nearly doubling the previous target. Publicly, there had been no firm word up until this week that Presidents Xi Jinping of China and Vladimir Putin of Russia would accept Biden's summit invite, given disputes with the U.S. over non-climate issues. But they did, despite concerns that international isolation and domestic political conflict under Trump had weakened the United States. Quote, "Nations still want to come to the party that the U.S. throws," said Alice Hill, a senior fellow for energy and environment at the Council on Foreign Relations. Xi, whose country is the world's number one climate polluter, held out the possibility in his summit speech of moving faster to slow China's building of new coal-fired power plants. He pledged to strictly control coal power, which sends a strong domestic message to Chinese provincial officials on future coal projects, said Yan Qin, a carbon analyst with the Refinitiv Carbon Group. South Korea's announcement at the summit that it would stop funding new coal-fired power plants abroad increased pressure on China and Japan, which still do, analysts said. Friday also featured billionaires Bill Gates and Mike Bloomberg, steelworker and electrical union leaders, and executives for solar and other renewable energy. Quote, "We can't beat climate change without a historic amount of new investment," said Bloomberg, who has spent heavily to promote replacing coal-fired power plants with increasingly cheaper renewable energy. It was all in service of an argument officials say will make or break Biden's climate vision. Pouring trillions of dollars into clean energy technology, research, and infrastructure will speed a competitive U.S. economy into the future and create jobs while saving the planet. While technological development and wider use has helped make wind and solar power strongly competitive against coal and natural gas in the U.S., Biden said investment also would bring forward thriving clean energy fields and things we haven't even thought of so far. Republicans are sticking to the arguments that Trump made in pulling the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Accord. They point to China as the world's worst climate polluter and say any transition to clean energy hurts American oil, natural gas, and coal workers. Biden envoy John Kerry stressed the presidential political selling point that rebuilding creaky U.S. infrastructure to run more cleanly would put the U.S. on a better economic footing long term. Quote, "No one is being asked for a sacrifice," Kerry said. "This is an opportunity," unquote. Iowans driving more, buying new vehicles, by James Q. Lynch. After months of concern that COVID-19 restrictions would negatively impact state transportation revenues, Iowa is reporting that increases in vehicle registrations and traffic volumes are bolstering the road use tax fund. Distributions to various appropriations and road funds were nearly $36.7 million higher this April than in April 2020, the Department of Transportation reported this week. Overall, year-to-year distributions are $26.1 million higher than last year. The April numbers could be due to the timing of the road use tax fund's distribution, according to Stuart Anderson, director of the DOT's Transportation Development Division. Quote, "It's very possible we'll see some reconciliation with the May numbers," he said. However, the only COVID-19 impact on the fund, he said, is reduced fuel tax revenue due to reduced travel. While traffic volume in the state is now close to pre-pandemic levels, Anderson said, the department will continue to track traffic levels closely to see if long-term changes in telework policies impact state road use tax fund revenues, unquote. In March 2020, the department's 120 automatic traffic recorders showed the number of vehicles on streets, roads, highways, and interstates had fallen by nearly 50% compared to the previous March. That meant Iowans were buying less fuel and paying less in fuel taxes, which make up about 40% of the $1.7 billion road use tax fund. The fund's two other primary revenue sources are annual vehicle registration fees and the 5% fee for new vehicle registration paid when a new or used vehicle is purchased. Growth in those areas is surpassing the lower fuel tax revenue, Anderson said. Quote, while there was an initial drop in vehicle sales early in the pandemic, we've now seen vehicle sales increase above forecast levels, and vehicle prices are also increasing, he said. Both of those factors, he said, are driving road use tax revenue above forecasts. DOT data shows total vehicle registrations climbing by 17,561 to 4,549,289 from 2019 to 2020. That exceeded the increase of 14,189 from 2018 to 2019. Vehicle registration revenue increased $22.2 million to $675.2 million in 2020. Money from the Road Use Tax Fund supports construction and maintenance of Iowa's roadways. Nearly half, 47.4%, goes to primary roads of the state highway system, 24.5% goes to secondary roads, 20% goes to cities, and 8% goes to farm-to-market roads. Suspect charged with murder and death of State Patrol Sergeant Jim Smith by Jeff Reinitz. Bond has been set at $3 million for a Grundy Center man accused of killing a state trooper in a standoff April 9th. Michael Thomas Lang, age 41, was taken to jail Wednesday after he was released from the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics in Iowa City, where he was taken after being detained in his barricaded home following the deadly confrontation. He had an initial appearance in Grundy County District Court and was then transferred to the Black Hawk County Jail in Waterloo. Lang, who had unsuccessfully launched a run for the Grundy Sheriff's seat last year, is charged with first-degree murder, attempted murder, and assault on an officer. Authorities said Lang killed Sergeant Jim Smith with the Iowa State Patrol with a shotgun as officers attempted to detain him following a traffic stop and a chase. The attempted murder charge stems from allegedly trying to kill state troopers in an armored vehicle during the standoff. The assault charge pertains to an attack on Grundy Center officer Cody Nahaus, according to court records. According to court records, Grundy Center police attempted to pull Lang over for a traffic stop at 7:22 p.m. on April 9th. Lang fled and was chased to an area southeast of town. Lang pulled over on 250th Avenue, exited his vehicle, and assaulted the Grundy Center police officer who chased him. During the assault, Lang yelled, "Shoot me," multiple times to the officer. Lang disarmed the officer of his taser, removed his radio, and put the officer in a chokehold, the affidavit alleges. Other law enforcement responded to the area of the assault. A Grundy County Sheriff's deputy arrived on scene, drew his weapon, and told Lang to put his hands up. Lang did not comply, stating, "Come get me," and got into his vehicle and fled the area. During the chase, the deputy lost sight of Lang and went to Lang's home at 305 G Avenue, where he saw Lang's vehicle parked in the driveway and Lang walking into the house through the garage. Responding officers set up a perimeter around the house. Lang's father arrived at the house and advised law enforcement that Lang had multiple firearms inside the home, including a .410 shotgun. At approximately 8:55 p.m., Sergeant Smith, three additional troopers, and a Hardin County Sheriff's K-9 unit entered through the garage. As Smith and the entry team began to clear the upstairs of the residence, Sergeant Smith was hit by gunfire coming from inside the residence, and members of the entry team saw Lang emerge from the doorway holding a black pump action shotgun. Two members of the entry team retreated into the basement while other members of the entry team pulled Smith from the house. Lang then barricaded himself inside the residence and refused to come out. Members of the entry team that remained in the basement stated Lang made several statements about having shot Smith and expressed a desire to shoot more police officers. Lang remained barricaded inside the residence for several hours. At approximately 11:50 p.m., an ISP tactical team attempted to make entry into the residence with a wheeled armored personnel carrier. During the entry, Lang shot multiple rounds at the personnel carrier. Lang was subsequently taken into custody by State Patrol tactical team members. We're a little bit past halfway here. A reminder that you are listening to the Mason City Globe Gazette, Saturday, April 24th edition, airing on Sunday, April 25th. We're going to take a moment here to go over to obituaries, starting with Bruce Lee Kratlov, age 71, of Clarion, who passed away Thursday, April 22nd at Iowa Specialty Hospital in Clarion. Massive Christian burial for Bruce Kratlov will be held on Thursday, April 29th at 10:30 a.m. at St. John's Catholic Church, 608 2nd Avenue Northeast in Clarion, with Father Jerry Blake officiating. Burial will be held at St. John's Catholic Cemetery in Clarion at 11 a.m. on Saturday, May 1st. Visitation will be held from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m., with a scriptural wake beginning at about 4:30 p.m. on Wednesday, April 28th, at Ewing Funeral Home, 1801 Central Avenue East in Clarion. Visitation will continue 1 hour prior to services at the church on Thursday. It looks like that was actually the only obituary today. It's always nice when we don't have too many for multiple reasons. So let's go back to the news here. U.S. to resume Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 shots by Laura Neergaard and Mike Stobie of the Associated Press. U.S. health officials lifted an 11-day pause on COVID-19 vaccinations using Johnson & Johnson's single-dose shot on Friday after scientific advisors decided its benefits outweigh a rare risk of blood clot. The government uncovered 15 vaccine recipients who developed a highly unusual kind of blood clot out of nearly 8 million people given the Johnson & Johnson shot. All were women, mostly under age 50. 3 died, and 7 remain hospitalized. But ultimately, Friday, the Food and Drug Administration and Centers for Disease Control and Prevention decided that Johnson & Johnson's one-and-done vaccine is critical to fight the pandemic, and that the small clot risk could be handled with warnings to help younger women decide if they should use that shot or an alternative. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said the Johnson & Johnson vaccine has important advantages for some people who were anxiously awaiting its return. The Food and Drug Administration updated online vaccine information leaflets for would-be recipients and health workers so that shots could resume as early as Saturday. Quote, "This is not a decision the agencies reached lightly," FDA Acting Commissioner Janet Woodcock said late Friday. CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky added that the pause should increase confidence in vaccine safety, showing that we are taking every one of those needles in a haystack that we find seriously. The U.S. decision, similar to how European regulators are rolling out Johnson & Johnson's shot, comes after CDC advisors earlier Friday voted 10 to 4, to resume vaccinations, but panelists made clear that they must come with warnings about the risk. The group debated but ultimately steered clear of outright age restrictions. Quote, "This is an age group that is most at risk of the clotting, that is getting vaccine predominantly to save other people's lives and morbidity, not their own. And I think we have a responsibility to be certain that they know this," said Dr. Sarah Long of Drexel University College of Medicine, who voted against the proposal because she felt it did not go far enough in warning women. The committee members all agreed the Johnson & Johnson vaccine should be put back into circulation. Panel Chairman Dr. Jose Romero, Arkansas's health secretary, said in an interview after the vote, "The difference was how you convey the risk. It does not absolve us from making sure that people who receive this vaccine, if they are in the risk group, that we inform them of that." European regulators earlier this week made a similar decision, deciding the clot risk was small enough to allow the rollout of Johnson & Johnson's shots. But how Americans ultimately handle Johnson & Johnson's vaccine will influence other countries that don't have as much access to other vaccination options. Dr. Paul Stoffels, Johnson & Johnson's chief scientific officer, pledged that the company would work with U.S. and global authorities to ensure this very rare event can be identified early and treated effectively. Johnson & Johnson already was working with the FDA on a warning label for the shot. And at issue is a weird kind of blood clot that forms in unusual places, such as veins that drain blood from the brain, and in patients with abnormally low levels of the platelets that form clots. Symptoms of the unusual clots, dubbed thrombosis with thrombocytopenia syndrome, include severe headaches a week or two after the Johnson & Johnson vaccination, not right away, as well as abdominal pain and nausea. The government initially spotted 6 cases of the rare clots, with 9 more cases coming to light in the last week or so. But even the first needle in a haystack reports raised alarm because European regulators already had uncovered similar rare clots among recipients of another COVID-19 vaccine from AstraZeneca. The AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson shots, while not identical, are made with the same technology. European scientists found clues that an abnormal platelet-harming immune response to AstraZeneca's vaccine might be to blame, and if so, then doctors should avoid the most common clot treatment, a blood thinner called heparin. That added to U.S. authorities' urgency in pausing Johnson & Johnson vaccinations so they could tell doctors how to diagnose and treat these rare clots. 6 patients were treated with heparin before anyone realized that might harm instead of help. In other developments, the CDC recommended that pregnant people receive COVID-19 vaccinations. Walensky announced the recommendation during an update on the pandemic at a White House briefing. She noted that a CDC study published this week found no safety concerns with Moderna and Pfizer vaccinations given during the third trimester of pregnancy. Quote, "I encourage people to talk to their doctors or primary care providers to determine what is best for them and for their baby," Walensky said. The European Medicines Agency said Friday that people who have received a first dose of AstraZeneca's COVID-19 vaccine should also get the second one, despite the rare risk of blood clots that have been linked to the shot. The Biden administration has taken the first step toward ending an emergency exception that allowed hospitals to ration and reuse N95 medical masks, the first line of defense between frontline workers and the deadly coronavirus. Up next here is the sports section. Jason Loeb works to build champions at Cutting Edge Fitness by Gunnar Davis. Walk up the stairs at Cutting Edge Fitness in Clear Lake, and one of the first things you'll see is a wall of nearly 60 athletes watching over every move you make. The athletes, ranging from former Iowa State women's basketball standout Jada Buckley to former South Dakota State football player Kane Lusher, are all players that originally started in North Iowa and worked with Cutting Edge Fitness owner Jason Loeb. The wall of photos is used as a way to reward the hard work of the athlete who accomplished their goals and motivation for the students Loeb trains today. Quote, "It motivates me to see people that have been in this gym that have succeeded being an athlete," Clear Lake 7th grader Luke Furman said. "He's just a great trainer and he's helped me so much," unquote. Furman is one of four 7th graders that came in and worked with Loeb at 6:30 a.m. on Monday morning. As a personal trainer and small business owner, Loeb works with individualized groups ranging from 5th graders all the way to an 80-year-old. But one of his favorite parts of the job is training middle school and high school athletes to be the best version of themselves and to, potentially, compete at the next level. Cutting Edge's motto, "We Build Champions," speaks to the success that Loeb has had since 2007, when he started at the gym in Clear Lake. Since then, he's trained 54 Division II or III players, 34 D1 players, and 5 professional athletes, from Alena League football to Major League Baseball's draftees. Some of his more recent North Iowa standouts include University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee women's basketball commit Jada Williams of Mason City, Iowa State football commit Caleb Bacon of Lake Mills, and University of Sioux Falls football commit Ben Peterson of Mason City. Quote, "I had the vision then, when I interviewed for the job here, to basically bring sports performance to North Iowa. There was a need for it," said Loeb, who has been owner for the past 11 years. "There was no one else in the area doing it. That was the vision. It started with one athlete in the spring of 2008, and it's grown to well over 200 and some athletes that have been through our doors in the past 14 years, unquote. As a former college football player at the University of Wisconsin River Falls, Loeb knew that he wanted to train athletes in strength and conditioning. He went on to work with players in college, the NFL, and the NBA before deciding to come to North Iowa. Outside of his business, Loeb also is the strength and conditioning coordinator at Waldorf University, so there's not a ton of free time in his life by any means. He has to get to know each individual athlete and their needs to come up with a specific program to make them better. Quote, "I love just the different ages, because from programming it, you have to think outside the box," Loeb said. "For instance, I have to be willing to adapt my program to base it on their needs," unquote. Loeb's resume in North Iowa high school athletics speaks for itself, and his students don't mind speaking about it for him. Quote, "In football and basketball, all my sports, I've been a lot faster and more agile on my feet," Furman said. "I feel like I'm higher up because I'm working with Jason. He's really helped me a lot, and I really appreciate him." NIACC's Christian Minto dominates to win national championship by Gunnar Davis. Christian Minto rolled to an 8-0 regular season record and dominated in all four of his tournament matches leading up to the NJCAA Division I National Championship match on Thursday night in Council Bluffs. So when Minto controlled Iowa Central's Keaton Geertz to win 13-6 in the 165-pound title match en route to becoming the NIACC's 14th national champion, head coach Steve Kelly wasn't surprised in the slightest. Quote, "He was really confident in his ability," Kelly said. "Felt good about his training leading up to it. He wrestled the kid in the past and knew some of his tendencies. The kid is tough, but Christian was just real confident in what he does," unquote. The first national championship win for Minto tastes sweet, especially after coming so close in his freshman campaign. Last season, he dropped a 6-4 decision in the championship match after previously going undefeated leading up to it. Thursday night's win was a perfect cap to a perfect season, but Minto isn't done yet, not by a long shot. Quote, "I think he's just got a lot of wrestling left in him," Kelly said. "A lot of untapped potential. He's just a good athlete. If the kid grew up playing basketball, he'd be a heck of a basketball player. He's just really athletic and very competitive. That's what makes him so good," unquote. Minto became the first Trojan wrestler to win a national championship since Austin Anderle in 2018. NIACC's Jose Valdez also competed in the 197-pound championship match against Cloud County's Zach Ferris on Thursday night. After going up 2-0, Valdez was called for stalling three times in the third period to lose in a 3-2 decision. Although Kelly didn't agree with the calls, he said Valdez took the loss the best way he could, despite the national title being taken from him. He, quote, "He knows how to deal with adversity. He knows how to move forward. It's us coaches. It seems like we're struggling with it more than him," Kelly said. "He called us today and said, 'Hey guys, how you doing?' He's more concerned about us, which just shows what type of guy he is," unquote. Between the loss and the win, two wrestlers competing in the national championships is a positive thing for NIACC moving forward. Area Roundup. St. Ansgar boys track picks up another win at North Iowa by Gunnar Davis. The St. Ansgar boys track team earned wins from five events and took home a team win over nine other teams at North Iowa with 130 points. After throwing the discus down at Drake Relays earlier in the day, Sage Holscheiser traveled back north and earned a win in the shot put with a heave of 46 feet 5 inches. In the same sense, Riley Witt competed in the 1600 meter at Drake and came back to win the 800 meter at North Iowa in a time of 2 minutes 4.12 seconds. Derek Peterson won the 400 meter hurdles at 1 minute and 0.82 seconds. Jax Schucher won the discus 120-00, and the 4x400 team won 3 minutes 38.9 seconds to round out the wins for the Saints. In boys track, Forest City places second at North Iowa. The Forest City boys track team also finished with five event wins, but still placed second with 94 points behind St. Ansgar at the North Iowa meet. The Indians won both jumping events on Thursday. Xavier Holland won the long jump with a leap of 20-02, and Elijah Weaver won the high jump with a jump of 6-00. The shuttle hurdle relay team ran a 1 minute 8.71 second. The 4x800 team ran a 8 minute 47.4 second, and the 4x200 team ran a 1 minute 36.34 seconds to all win events for the Indians. West Fork finishes in third. The West Fork boys team wasn't far behind Forest City, but the Warhawks scored 89 points to finish in third place at North Iowa on Thursday night. The Warhawks earned an individual event win and two team wins. Noah Mask was the winner in the 3200 meter with a time of 11 minutes 6.26 seconds. Not far behind him in second place was West Fork's Josh Hagen at 11 minutes and 7.44 seconds. West Fork's distance medley team won the event with a time of 4 minutes and 0.81 seconds, while the spring medley team won the event in 1 minute 42.02 seconds. The Warhawks also earned a few second-place finishes to score points as well. Lake Mills-Northwood-Kensett tie for fourth. Both the Lake Mills and Northwood-Kensett boys track teams finished with 62 points, which put the two teams in a tie for the fourth-place spot at North Iowa. Newman Catholic finished 10th to round out area teams. The top finisher for Northwood-Kensett was Josiah Clement, who ran a 54.59 to win the 400-meter dash. Lake Mills' best finish came in the 4x100-meter relay race. The team of Carson Eaton, Deshaun Lennon, Logan Bacon, and Caleb Bacon won the race in a time of 46.32 seconds. Now in boys golf, Newman Catholic wins at Rockford. The Newman Catholic boys golf team broke through at Rockford and had a solid night. The Knights had the first and second place individual finishers and won the three-team meet with 170 total strokes. Newman Catholic edged out Central Springs with 185 and Rockford 201 to earn the win on Thursday night. Junior Tim Castle shot a season-low 37 to medal for the Knights. Not far behind him was Newman Catholic junior Nash Holmgard, 42, and senior Cade Schilling, 44. Justice Jones shot a 45 to lead Rockford. There were no individual scores recorded for the Panthers. Osage edges out Northwood-Kensett, West Fork. The Osage boys golf team earned another top finish at Northwood Country Club on Thursday night. Although the Green Devils' score wasn't as low as it's been in the past, the squad still shot 181 to edge out Northwood Kensett, 193, and West Fork, 198. Bodie Goddard led the Green Devils with a 44, which was good for a tie with West Fork's Landon Showalter for medalist honors. Osage's Nolan Hurd and Tristan Monk, Northwood Kensett's Carter Severson, all shot a 45 to round out the top five scores. Clear Lake finishes second at Spencer. The Clear Lake boys golf team traveled to Spencer for an 18-hole meet on Thursday night. The Lions shot a 335 to finish in second place out of eight teams. The only team to beat Clear Lake was Spirit Lake, with 312. There were no individual stats on Varsity Bound for Clear Lake. Girls Golf, Osage earns team win at Northwood. The Osage girls golf team had just as much team success as the boys team on Thursday at Northwood. The Green Devils shot a team score of 223 to edge out West Fork, 253, and Northwood Kensett, 256. Emma Davidson from Northwood Kensett medaled with a score of 49. After Davidson, Osage held the next five best individual scores. Danny Johnson shot a 51 to place second, and Sammy Brandow shot a 54 to place third. The top scorer for West Fork was Haley McCoy, 62. Newman Catholic beats Rockford in duel. The Newman Catholic and Rockford girls golf teams competed in a dual meet in Rockford on Thursday. The Knights scored a 209 to beat the Warriors, 281. The Knights' four golfers had the best four scores of the day. Leah Martinez and Emma Weiner both shot scores of 50 to lead, while the Warriors were led by Olivia Goodrich, 66. In girls soccer, Clear Lake 3, Mason City 0. In an east-west interstate rivalry game, the Clear Lake girls soccer team edged out Mason City 3-0 on Thursday night in Clear Lake. The Lions scored one goal in the first half and two goals in the second half to earn the victory and move to 3-2. The Mohawks had 19 shots on goal but didn't convert any. Mason City dropped to 2-3. Quote, "It was a very disappointing loss for us," Mason City coach Shannon Dykstra said. Despite controlling possession for most of the game, we were unable to get a finish in the final third when we needed it. We made two or three mental mistakes, and they made us pay every time. It's disappointing to play well in many aspects of the game and not come away with a result, but we'll learn from this and move forward. Hampton Dumont Cal 1, Garner Hayfield Ventura 0. The Hampton Dumont Cal and Garner Hayfield Ventura girls soccer teams were locked in a tight contest for most of Thursday night in Hampton. However, it was the home Bulldogs who came away with a 1-0 win. The lone goal of the evening was scored in the second period by junior Franka Schmid. This was the first win of the year for the Bulldogs, who improved to 1-3. Meanwhile, the Cardinals dropped to 4-1. In boys soccer, Garner Hayfield Ventura 5, Hampton Dumont Cal 1. Garner Hayfield Ventura had no trouble dealing with Hampton Dumont Cal on Thursday night. The Cardinals beat the Bulldogs 5-1. Kevin Myers recorded a hat trick for the Cardinals, while Isaac Knutson and Braden Banky each scored one goal as well. Quote, "Kevin is a very aggressive, fine soccer player. I think tonight he really made that known to this area," GHV coach Josh Bansey said. "When it comes to putting a team of different grades together, it takes time for them to gel. Tonight was another step in the right direction," unquote. GHV improved to 4-4 with the win, while HDC dropped to 1-2. In boys tennis, Marshalltown 7, Mason City 4. The Marshalltown boys tennis team just got the better of visiting Mason City on Thursday night. The Mohawks lost 7-4 to the Bobcats. Zach Mulholland was the lone individual winner for Mason City. The Mohawks recorded wins in three double matches, but the Bobcats had already locked up the victory. In girls tennis, Mason City 6, Marshalltown 5. The Mason City and Marshalltown girls tennis teams took part in a tight battle on Thursday night in Mason City. In the end, the Mohawks were able to pull out a 6-5 win. The two teams split the individual series with three wins each. Mason City earned wins from Celine Matthews, Riley Brick, and Ashley Latham. In the doubles matches, that's when Mason City earned three wins to edge out the Bobcats. We are almost out of time here, so I'm finding a short article, "Olympic Athletes Promised Legal Support If They Protest," by Graham Dunbar from the Associated Press. Athletes who make political or social justice protests at the Tokyo Olympics were promised legal support Thursday by a global union and an activist group in Germany. The pledges came one day after the International Olympic Committee confirmed its long-standing ban on demonstration or political, religious, or racial propaganda on the field of play, medal podiums, or official ceremonies. Raising a fist or kneeling for a national anthem could lead to punishment from the IOC. The Olympic body's legal commission should clarify what kind of punishment before this year's games, which open on July 23rd. The IOC also said that slogans such as Black Lives Matter will not be allowed on athlete apparel at Olympic venues, though it approved using the words peace, respect, solidarity, inclusion, and equality on t-shirts. The IOC's Athletics Commission cited support to uphold Rule 50 of the Olympic Charter for more than two-thirds of about 3,500 replies from consulting athlete groups. Quote, "This is precisely the outcome we expected," said Brendan Schwab, executive director of the World Players Association Union. "The Olympic movement doesn't understand its own history better than the athletes," unquote. Speaking to the Associated Press in a telephone interview from Australia, Schwab said, "Any athlete sanctioned at the Tokyo Olympics will have the full backing of the world players." The independent group representing German athletes pledged legal backing for its national team. Should German athletes decide to peacefully stand up for fundamental values such as fighting racism during the Olympic Games, they can rely on the legal support of Athleten Deutschland, Johannes Herber, the group's chief executive, said in a statement. In a statement, another athlete group, Global Athlete, encouraged athletes to not allow outdated sports rules to supersede your basic human rights. It said the survey's methods were flawed. Quote, "These types of surveys only empower the majority when it is the minority that want and need to be heard," said Ireland's Carad O'Donovan, a karate athlete who helped start Global Athlete. All right, I think that gets us pretty close here. I couldn't finish that article, unfortunately. So that does it for today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Saturday, April 24th, airing on Sunday, April 25th. I'm your reader, Natalie Chin. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thank you for listening.